generate our motivation. And so think that we'll listen and discuss and learn this evening. So we can especially learn how to counteract our anger, and in that way stop so many problems from occurring in this life and future lives, and how we can develop a heart that is kind towards others and respects other living beings, which is our contribution to world peace. And let's do this for the long-term purpose of becoming fully awakened Buddhas, so we can act very effectively for the benefit of others without being heated by bias, attachment, or anger. Okay, so we'll finish off the questions from yesterday, and then I think we'll finish the chapter today. Okay, so how do we handle feelings of injustice when people who don't work or don't deserve it get promoted? Oh, I am so jealous. I worked so hard and they didn't. And the boss is playing favorite and it's unfair. How many of you have the feeling that things are unfair in your life? Interesting. How many of you feel like you sometimes have the best deal? You know, when things are unfair, that you have the best part of the unfairness? How many of you feel that you get the worst part of the unfairness? How many of you are afraid to tell the truth? I often joke that in the U.S., some, the first words that American children learn after mama and Papa is, it's not fair. Yeah? Because I remember all the time when I was growing up, you know? I had a younger brother and then many years later a younger sister. But especially with my brother, yeah, my parents wouldn't let me do things because I was the oldest one and they were afraid. But he was the second one, so I broke my parents in, and then he got to do things I didn't get to do, and it's not fair. And whenever we had a quarrel, I got blamed because I was the older one and I should know better. Yeah, yeah, all you older ones understand what I mean. It's not fair. And I think I told you the other night that my primary second teacher wouldn't let me be in the class play. Yeah, I remember that. That was over 50 years ago. But it wasn't fair. So, what, you know, just through my own recollection, my own looking at my own mind, I think that, you know, most of us go through life feeling that it's not fair and that other people have it better than we do. And now if that were accurate, that means nobody would have the better part of the unfairness. Yeah, everybody would be just like us on the lower half. It's not fair. But whenever it's not fair, somebody's got to have the better part of the deal. How come it is that nobody feels that they have the better part of the deal in when life is unfair? Quite interesting, isn't it? Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah, very seldom do you meet people who say, wow, I have privilege. Everybody walks around. It's not fair. Yeah. And then we grow up and we grow old with this feeling of jealousy and resentment, and we just nourish jealousy and resentment our whole lives. Yeah, because other people have a better deal than we have. But when we nourish jealousy and resentment, what happens to us? Does it change the external situation, the unfairness? No, our jealousy, our resentment doesn't change the external situation at all. What does it do? It makes us miserable, doesn't it? And I don't know about you, but for me, jealousy is one of the most painful emotions. You know, it's a horrible emotion, because I don't know. You know what I mean? Yeah? I mean, when you feel jealous, you just feel so icky. And I remember, you know, in my training, being jealous of other students of my teacher. You know, they had more time with my teacher, and they were better than me, they this, they that, you know. And I was in so much pain from my jealousy that at one point I just said, I have to change, because I can't endure this jealousy anymore. You know, it's just too painful. So the antidote to jealousy is rejoicing. Of course, rejoicing is the last thing we want to do when we feel jealous, which is why it's the antidote to jealousy. And so to train our mind to feel happy when others have goodness, whether they deserve it or don't deserve it, yeah, whether things are fair or not fair, to just train our mind to say, somebody's happy. Isn't that nice in this world that's so full of dukkha that somebody else is happy? When you think of it, it's good, isn't it? I mean, there's so much misery in this world that when somebody else is happy and we didn't even have to do anything for them to be happy, then it only makes sense that we rejoice. But we feel when we rejoice like we're burning up, don't we? Yeah. Like, oh, I rejoice. Oh, but it's not fair, and I should have that happiness, not them. I want to clobber them. I want to steal away this good opportunity. It's not fair. It becomes exhausting for us. Yeah. So, you know, in my own struggle with my jealousy, I've really had to come to see that actually the world is a better place because I'm not the best. If I were the best, we would be living like cave people. Because I don't know anything about electricity, except how to turn on and the on and off the switch and how to change a light bulb. That's it. So if I were the best, no electricity. If I were the best, also no plumbing. I don't know anything about plumbing, again, except how to turn on the faucet and how to turn it off and how to use a, you know, the plunger when it gets stuck. That's it. Okay. If I were the best, we wouldn't have cars. We wouldn't have refrigerators. We wouldn't have buildings. Because I don't know how to make any of those things. So when I actually think about it, you know, it's really good that there are other people that are better than me. Really, if I were the best, big problems. Now, you might say, well, in your own field, don't you want to be best? Well, when am I ever going to be the best Dharma teacher? When am I ever going to be the best Dharma practitioner? I mean, come on. It's not a competition. Yeah. It's not a competition. And anyway, again, if I were best, boy, our level of Dharma practice and Dharma knowledge would be way down there. Because it's really good that there's other people who are better practitioners than me and who know more than I do. Yeah. And because other people are better than me, then I have the opportunity to learn. If I were the best one, I couldn't learn anything. And really big problems. Okay? So, you know, in this situation, this person speaking of, you know, the colleague gets the promotion and you don't. I think you have to be careful too of what you get jealous of. Because you might one day get it. And if you get the promotion, then you have the distinguished honor of working 12-hour days and spending less time with your family, being more stressed out. Yes, you may make more money, but you have to spend that money to send your child to a therapist because your children feel unloved because you aren't around because you're working 12-hour days. So what kind of benefit is that? Yeah? Does the person who get the promotion really get more happiness? I don't think so. Yeah? We always want to be the best. Yeah? I want to be the best. I want to be the richest. I want to be the most famous. But if you really think about it, what would your life be like if you were the richest, best, and most famous person? And really think about what would life be like. So some years ago, Bill Gates' best friend was dying of cancer. And he was a Buddhist. And the family asked me to come and help. And it was a remarkable death, and the memorial service was at Bill Gates' house. You know, he had this huge thing on Lake Washington, and you know, I went there and I led the service and everything. And then after I left, it was a very beautiful memorial service. After I left, I just walked down the street and I thought, wow, I can walk down the street. Bill Gates and his family could not walk down the street. Yeah. His children can't go outside and play Because can you imagine if somebody kidnapped Bill Gates's kid? What would happen? How much ransom they would ask? You know, Bill and Melinda Gates can't go out in public. They can't take a walk in the park, or take a walk on the beach, or go to the grocery store. They would be mobbed. And I felt so free, because I could just walk down the street, nobody cares. If I were rich and famous, I couldn't walk down the street. So, you know, sometimes we need to be careful of our jealousy, because it might lead us to a situation where actually we have less happiness. Yeah? In other words, if we get what we're jealous of other people for having, we may be more miserable. Okay? Then the next question is probably going to be, at work, I got the promotion and somebody else in the department didn't. And they resent me and are jealous of me, and I feel so miserable at work now. What do I do? That's probably the next question. So, I wonder, what does the Dalai Lama feel, or what does he say about the Chinese invasion of Tibet? Well, I think His Holiness feels sad about it. It's his homeland. He's been a refugee since 1959, since he was 24 years old. He's now 80. And he had to watch genocide in Tibet, deforestation, environmental disaster, and he couldn't do anything about it. So I think those things have been quite difficult for him. According to the Beijing government, he's the worst thing that ever appeared on the earth. He's the splitter of the motherland, and so forth and so on. His Holiness doesn't really care about what names they call him. I don't think that bothers him at all. I saw an interview some years ago. There was a journalist from the Los Angeles Times who was interviewing His Holiness when he was in LA. And they commented, you know, they said, "You, there's been all this problem in your homeland and everything." So this journalist was saying, you know, there's been genocide, there's been environmental devastation. How come you seem so calm? And His Holiness, so the journalist was actually giving His Holiness a platform to then say, they did this and they did that and it's not fair and nah. They were giving His Holiness the platform to complain about the communist occupation. Instead, His Holiness said, if I were angry, what good would it do? It wouldn't change anything in Tibet. And he said, if I were angry over the occupation, then I couldn't sleep well at night. I couldn't enjoy my food, and nothing would change in the situation. So what's the use of being angry? So this journalist is looking at His Holiness like, oh my God, what are you saying, you know? Because what he said was completely true, and he was not taking up that open platform to then criticize and yell and complain. And he's constantly telling the Tibetan people, don't be angry at the communist Chinese. Yeah. Still, you have, you know, you stand up and you say what happened is, you know, it's an illegal occupation, you say that, but you don't have to be angry at anybody. And if you look at the situation of the Palestinians and the Tibetans, both of which lost their land about the same time, the late 1940s, yeah, how many people have died in the Palestinian endeavor to have their own country? Lots. Yeah, thousands of people have died. Yeah, there's been terrorist attacks, there's been bombings, there's been two intifadas, you know, so many people have died. How many people have died in the Tibetans' search to have their own autonomy? Not very many. Okay? So they really are adhering to a nonviolent policy. And you can say, well, they don't have their homeland, even though they're nonviolent. But neither do the Palestinians. So it's not like violence gets you what you want. Yeah. And His Holiness is very well respected internationally for his nonviolent stance. Whereas Arafat and, you know, certainly Hamas are not respected throughout the world for nonviolence. In fact, quite the opposite. Okay? Then, I try to respond to behavior I don't like by being nice and keeping their potential in mind. But it doesn't work. Each time my effort fails to get the result I'd hope for, anger is generated. And because I still want to be nice, I have developed a habit of repressing my anger and being unaware of my anger when it first arises. Is this an ego problem? Yes. Where I just don't want to be, I just want to be a people pleaser. Sounds like it. Yeah. It's like a line I'm not sure where I'm standing on between remembering people's potential and being nice. Yeah. Okay. So we have to look at why we're being nice. Yeah. If, you know, the original situation, okay, so people are doing something that we find objectionable. Yeah. And we stuff down our anger and we're nice. Yeah. Because, and my guess is it's probably a woman writing this question. Yeah? Because we women are socialized that we are not supposed to express anger. We are supposed to be nice. And if we're at all, forget expressing anger, if we're at all assertive, we're called names. Yeah. I see this very often because I'm in a leadership position. If, you know, a man acts the way I act, no problem. If I as a woman, you know, am assertive, who does she think she is? So it's not fair now. But in any case, whether you're male or female, stuffing in our anger doesn't work. Because when we stuff it in, it's still there, and it comes out in one way or another. Okay, so the thing about working with anger, it's not about repressing the anger. It's about learning to look at the situation in a totally different way so that we aren't angry to start with. Okay? So it's not about being nice so that other people don't criticize us, or being nice so that they like us. Yeah, it's about working with our own anger and learning to subdue it, and then learning to communicate in an effective way in a situation of conflict with the other person. You getting what I'm saying? Usually when there's conflict, the thing we first say is, what do I do? What do I do? Wrong question. Yeah, it's not a thing of what do I do. It's, how do I calm my mind? How do I see that the story behind my anger is inaccurate? It's not true. That the story behind my anger is just a manifestation of my own self-centeredness. That's the question to ask. Okay. Then, after our mind is calm, it becomes much easier to just know what to do. Yeah, because when we're calm, then we can look at the situation and think, well, you know, what needs to be worked out with this other person? And then we can go to them and hopefully work it out. Okay? So, it's not about being nice. Because I'm so afraid you won't like me. Yeah. We're afraid other people won't like us, aren't we? As if other people don't like us, it means we're a bad person. Is that true? No. Yeah. Just because somebody doesn't like us doesn't mean we're bad. Yeah. If Jihadi John doesn't like you, does that mean you're bad? Come on. Okay. Let's go back to the text. Okay. So we're on verse 127. So this is moving into a different section, talking about the benefits of practicing fortitude. Okay, so it says, pleasing living beings delights the Tathagatas and perfectly accomplishes my own purpose as well. In addition, it dispels the pain and misery of the universe. Therefore, I should always practice it. Okay, so the benefits of fortitude first. Pleasing living beings, respecting living beings, not because we're being people pleasers, but because we really genuinely care about them. We see their Buddha potential. Yeah. So when we act that way with sincerity, then the Tathagatas, the Buddhas, are pleased. So that's one benefit. Yeah. We don't want to be a people pleaser for sentient beings. But doing things that accord with what the Buddha would like us to do is worthwhile. What's the difference? The Buddha's wise. Sentient beings are fickle. Okay? Second benefit. Yeah, perfectly accomplishes my own purpose as well. Okay? So our own purpose means attaining the Dharmakaya, the truth body, the mind, the omniscient mind of the Buddha. So how does respecting and caring for sentient beings help us attain the Buddha's mind? Well, yeah, to attain the Buddha's mind, we need both wisdom and bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the altruistic intention that is based on having impartial love and compassion for each and every sentient being. Remember a couple of days ago I was saying if we leave even one sentient being out of the realm of our compassion that we can't become Buddhas. Yeah? So we're dependent on each sentient being. If we care for sentient beings, yeah, then we're able to generate impartial love and compassion for all of them. Then we can generate bodhicitta for them. And then with bodhicitta, we can do all sorts of wonderful actions that benefit sentient beings. And in that way, accumulate incredible amounts of merit. And the collection of merit is something very, very important for attaining Buddhahood. Okay? So being kind towards sentient beings helps us to create merit, helps us attain enlightenment. Okay? Then the third one, it says, and in addition, it, meaning fortitude, dispels the pain and misery of the universe. So dispelling the pain and misery of the universe is accomplishing the purpose of others, because that's what others want. They don't want pain and misery. So if we can dispel it, then, you know, it fulfills the purpose of other sentient beings. So it's true, when we act with kindness, when we act with respect to other beings, yeah, it dispels pain and misery, doesn't it? Yeah, right away. You just try it, even on simple things. Try in your family being polite. I know it sounds ridiculous, but families, the family members often are not very polite to each other. They take each other so much for granted that they don't speak in a very respectful way to each other. Yeah. And then we wonder why people's marriages aren't very happy. Yeah. But if you try just on basic level, using basic human kindness, yeah, basic human manners, say please and thank you to your family members. Yeah. How much, you know, do you say that? When a family member cleans something, cleans your house, do you say thank you? Yeah. How about with your kids? How do you act towards your kids? Are you a drill sergeant? Get up. You're late. Wash behind your ears. Brush your teeth. You're late. You're late. Hurry up. Did you do your homework? Oh, no, you didn't do your homework. I know the dog ate it again. Yeah, that doesn't matter. Do your homework. Sit down. Do your homework. No, you can't play. You cannot watch TV. You cannot play on the computer. Do your homework. Yeah, eat your spinach. I don't care if you don't like spinach, you don't like vegetables. Eat it. You have two choices. Take it or leave it. Yeah. You speak to your kids like you're a drill sergeant in the army. Yeah? Does that create a happy family? Are your kids going to open up and talk to you about their problems when you speak like that to them all the time? Yeah? So sometimes just basic human manners. Slow down, be polite. Yeah? Acknowledge what people do well in your family and at work. Yeah? Just start with small things. Yeah, but it can make a huge difference. Huge, huge difference. So often we just take people we're close to for granted, and all we do is complain about them. At home, you complain about your bosses and your colleagues. At work, you complain about your family. Yeah. Does that make you happy? Are you happy when you complain? No, we're miserable when we complain. And we all say, well, I'm complaining because they did da-da-da. I don't care if they did da-da-da-da. When we complain, we're miserable. So, we want to stop being miserable, stop complaining, and start looking at the good things the people around us do. Because there is a lot of goodness and there's a lot of help. And it's really wonderful when we can acknowledge these things in other people. Instead of always, oh, yeah, I know you made my dinner and you worked hard to make my dinner, but you didn't make what I like. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, always we're picking at faults, aren't we? Complaining. I have my PhD in complaining. Yeah. But the university who gave it to me didn't even spell my name right. They give me a diploma in complaining and they misspell my name. Oh my God. Nothing ever goes right for me. This ridiculous university. Yeah. Okay, so you know, we can find anything and everything to complain about. If you ever need somebody to complain about something for you, ask me. I'm very good at it. Yeah? My complaint factory operates 24/7. Never shuts down. Even in my dreams, I complain. Yeah? I don't recommend it as a path to happiness. Okay. So there, right in that verse, we have three of the benefits of practicing fortitude. Yeah? Delighting the Tathagatas, accomplishing our own purpose, and dispelling the pain and misery of the world. Yeah. So that's our contribution to world peace. You know, what we do as one individual is very important in terms of creating world peace. Because you see, all we need, all the world needs is one individual who's wacko. And they incite everybody else, and then we have so much war and turbulence. So if we as one individual, you know, can practice fortitude, subdue our anger, it's really a substantial contribution to world peace. Okay, 128. For example, oh, I'm going to read the next few verses all together. They fit together. For example, should some of the king's men cause harm to many people, far-sighted ones would not return the harm, even if they were able to do so. For they see that these men are not alone, but are supported by the might of the king. Likewise, I should not underestimate weak beings who cause me a little harm, for they are supported by the guardians of hell, and by all the compassionate ones. So behaving like the subjects of that fiery king, I should please all sentient beings. Okay, so there's an example here. So if you had like a very vicious king that was causing harm to people, yeah, you wouldn't directly challenge those people and retaliate, because you know that they're represented by the king and the might of the king is behind them. And if you destroy the king's troops, the king is going to get furious and send more troops to make you more miserable. Okay? So the idea here is that in terms of sentient beings, how we respond to sentient beings, yeah, has behind it, yeah, either the force of the guardians of hell or the force of the compassionate Buddhists. The idea being that if we harm sentient beings, then the guardians of hell are ready there to, you know, manifest in our world and make us miserable. If we benefit sentient beings, the Tathagatas will be pleased, and they manifest in our world and guide us to awakening. That's the meaning of it, that behind the sentient beings, there are other forces. Just as in the example, behind those troops, there's the kings. Then 31, even if such a king were to become angry, could he cause the pain of hell, which is the fruit I would have to experience by displeasing sentient beings? And even if such a king were to be kind, he could not possibly grant me Buddhahood, which is the fruit I would obtain by pleasing sentient beings. So here, the idea is that we're usually very afraid of worldly power, like a king. But can a king send us to the lower realms? Can a king make us be born in the hell realm? No. Yeah, the government can issue an edict saying, go to hell. But they can't make us be born in hell. Who makes us get born in hell? We do. Our ignorance, anger, and attachment that motivate our destructive karma, those are the real enemies that make us have a lower rebirth. Other sentient beings, no matter what they do to us, cannot make us have a bad rebirth. The most damage other sentient beings can ever cause us is to kill us and to end this life. But they cannot make us have bad future lives. But our afflictions can. So rather than fear sentient beings, rather than retaliate against sentient beings, we should see the danger of our own ignorance, anger, and attachment, and we should try and overcome those disturbing emotions before they damage us. Okay. Then, even if the king, even if some worldly power liked us, can somebody who has worldly power make you become a Buddha? Can the UN pass a resolution? So and so should become a Buddha? No, of course not. Who makes us become Buddhas? We do. If we nourish our kindness, our compassion, our wisdom, our discriminating awareness, our mindfulness, our introspective awareness, if we nourish these things, we make ourselves become Buddhas. So we don't need to, do a tap dance to please a king. We need to create the cause through our own virtuous actions. Okay? So, worldly power cannot grant us Buddhahood. And this is, but being kind to sentient beings can give us Buddhahood. Because by being kind to sentient beings, we create so much merit, and then that propels us along the path. Okay? Shantideva makes really good arguments, doesn't he? He says all sorts of things that we never thought of before, but when you really think about what he says, he's right. So verse 133, why do I not see that my future attainment of Buddhahood, as well as glory, renown, and happiness in this life, all come from pleasing sentient beings? So when you really think of the benefits of caring for sentient beings, of benefiting sentient beings, our future attainment of Buddhahood, that's the best thing we could ever have. Plus, if you're interested in this life's happiness, you also get glory and renown and happiness in this life from benefiting sentient beings and caring for them. So if it brings us happiness, why don't we do it? Why do we want to harm sentient beings and in the process create the cause for our own lower rebirth? And why do we resist benefiting sentient beings when the karmic result of that is our own happiness, our own attainment of spiritual realization? And even in this life, people will like us more. Yeah? When you really think about it, we human beings sometimes are so foolish. We're really stupid. Yeah? We want to be happy, but we run away from creating the causes of happiness. We don't want suffering, but we delight in creating the causes for it. Yeah? So we need to be a little bit smarter about how the law of karma and its effects functions, so we can stop shooting ourselves in the foot. Okay? And then 134, while in cyclic existence, fortitude causes beauty, health, and renown. Because of these, I shall live for a very long time and win the extensive pleasure of the universal chakra of Chakravarti kings. Okay? So of course, practicing fortitude leads to full awakening. But while we're in samsara, it also brings beauty, health, and renown. Now you're going to ask, well, how does practicing fortitude bring beauty, health, and renown? Okay, first of all, is an angry person physically attractive? No. Anything but that. Okay? So anger makes us ugly. When we practice the opposite of anger, fortitude, kindness towards others, we have a pleasing expression on our face. We have a pleasing face. You know, we look better, don't we? Okay? So right then and there, it's going to attract people towards us. Okay, we have renown. You know, people who are kind get praised by other people. Yeah. I mean, you may find a lot of people talking about Donald Trump, so you can get famous by being mean. Yeah. But having good kind of renown and being praised is a different ballgame. Nobody praises Donald Trump for being kind. Everybody looks at him like, who is this guy? You know, I mean, some people like his policies, but, well, anyway, I won't talk about that. I respect him as a human being, as somebody who has Buddha nature. But I disagree with his ideas. Okay, so, you know, so if we practice patience, you know, we have beauty, health, renown, you know. They've done studies, if we're angry, it impedes our recovering when we're sick. If we practice fortitude, we have a calm mind. It is conducive to healing. Yeah? And you can see it, you know, when we're tense and we're angry, we don't feel well right then and there, do we? Our stomach's knotted up, our heart's going thump, 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 thump. You know? Just physically, we don't feel well. So, anger's not so good for our health. Okay? And so, I mean, the whole point is here that practicing anger as a strategy in life creates our own and others' suffering. Practicing fortitude and benefiting others creates the cause for our own and others' happiness. Okay. So that's the end of the sixth chapter. Next year we'll start on the seventh chapter, which is about joyous effort. but we still have some time tonight. And so I thought to teach from another thought training text called the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas, and to pick out some of the verses here that talk about how to practice fortitude and how to subdue anger. Okay? So the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas is a very short text. It's very beautiful, and we have two books downstairs that are commentaries on it. So one is a book written by one of my teachers called Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage, and he gives a really thorough commentary on it. And if you're interested in the taking and giving meditation, he gives a really beautiful description of it in chapter 11. And then a book I wrote called Don't Believe Everything You Think. That's also a commentary on the 37 practices. So I thought to pick out a few of the 37 practices and comment on them for you, because they really teach us how to work with our mind. Okay. So there's a whole section here, about thought training, and it's preceded by one verse. It's verse 11 that says, "All suffering comes from the wish for your own happiness. Perfect Buddhas are born from the thought to help others. Therefore, exchange your own happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of bodhisattvas." So this first line, all suffering comes from the wish for your own happiness. That's pretty strong, isn't it? But if we look, our self-centered thought does cause us so much misery. Whenever we harm others, underneath it is our self-centered thought. All of the negative karma we've created, motivated by our self-centered thought. Whereas perfect Buddhas are born from the thought to help others. So all the good in the world comes from having the wish to be a benefit to other living beings. Now if you look at it, don't you wish for other sentient beings to benefit you? Could you use some benefit? We want others to benefit us. Wouldn't it be fair if we also tried to benefit them? Okay. So we can see how good we'd feel when others benefit us. How good could we make others feel if we were really considerate of their feelings and needs? It would change a lot of things in this world. Imagine one day if everybody just practiced benefiting others. What would the newspapers write about? The newspapers would be totally different. Wouldn't that be nice? Everybody spends one day benefiting others instead of just looking out for themselves. May it be wonderful, wouldn't it? So then, now we're going into the thought training verses. And I should warn you, these thought training verses, they give a situation, and then they give us a way to practice to change it. The way to practice is usually the last thing we want to do, which is why it's the measure that counteracts the problem. Okay? So listen to this one. Even if someone out of strong desire steals all your wealth or has it stolen. Okay, so there's some guy who's just so greedy. I'm not even talking about a thief that breaks into your house. Maybe somebody on Wall Street. who's very greedy, who steals all your wealth or has it stolen. So you're impoverished because of somebody else's greed. How are we supposed to practice? Listen to this. Dedicate to him your body, possessions, and your virtue, past, present, and future. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. How do you feel about that? This guy just stole all your stuff. And we're being told to dedicate our body, possessions, and virtue of the past, present, and future to this complete idiot who stole all my stuff and is making me miserable. I have every right to be mad and to retaliate. That's how we would usually feel, isn't it? And he's the author of this text, Tome Zampo, is telling us to do the opposite of what we, as, childish sentient beings would normally do. Okay. So why does he tell us, dedicate to him your body, possessions, and your virtue? Past, present, and future, everything I'm supposed to dedicate to this guy. Yeah? Why? How am I supposed to do that? Well, first of all, he's stealing all my possessions. And this is a result of karma I've created in the past. Yeah? I stole all of somebody else's possessions. Or I ruined people's possessions. I did something horrible regarding other people's possessions in the past, either earlier this life or in a previous life. And so my having nice things stolen now is the karmic result of what I did to others in the past. Is that unfair? No, it's fair, isn't it? I put that energy out in the universe in the past due to my own self-centered attitude, harming others' possessions, depriving them of what was theirs. Now it's coming back to me. Why should I be angry? Why should I complain when I created the principal cause for it? Think about it. This situation actually happened to me a couple of years ago. Yeah, there was something that was supposed to be mine, and it didn't wind up getting to be mine. And at first I was like, I was upset. And then I thought, this is just the result of my own actions. Why should I be upset? Yeah. And the argument of, it should be mine, he should give it to me. Well, in the past, if I deprived somebody else of their possessions and didn't give them what was rightfully theirs, why am I complaining when the thing happens to me? Yeah. I need to learn from this situation. And what do I need to learn? To respect others' possessions. To respect other living beings. To give them what is rightfully theirs. To not cheat them. Not lie to them. Not deprive them of their possessions. Okay? In short, what I need to do is to dedicate my body and possessions and virtue to other living beings. Because anyway, anything I have isn't actually mine. If you look at it, anything we have was given to us by others or created in reference to other living beings. When you were born, when we were born completely broke, weren't we? We all came out of our mother's womb without any money, without any possessions, zero. And look at all the things that we've had since we were born. They all came to us, they were all given to us by other living beings. It's true, isn't it? You might say, but I worked hard for it, that's my wages. But still, somebody paid us, the money came from others. And where did we get the knowledge and the skill to go to do our job at work? That came also from others too, didn't it? All the skills that you have, that you use at your job, were you born with that knowledge and those skills? No. When we were born, all we could do was go, We peed, we pooped, and we spit up and cried. And then we learned to smile, which is a good thing otherwise. Smiling babies saves the whole day. So verse 13. Even if, this is a good one, even if someone tries to cut off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so even somebody tries to cut off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong. That doesn't happen too often. Thank goodness. But even if people mistreat us or falsely accuse us or blame us when we haven't done anything wrong, we've all had that situation. So how are we supposed to practice? Out of compassion, take all of that person's misdeeds upon ourselves. In other words, with compassion, want to experience the negative, the painful effects of that person's negative karma. This is getting into the taking and giving meditation, where we imagine taking others' suffering, giving them our happiness. And here's somebody who's causing us happiness, unhappiness, when we haven't done anything. And what are we supposed to do? Take on their unhappiness and give them our happiness. I was reading an article yesterday. You know, there was the shooting in San Bernardino a few days ago. And San Bernardino is quite close to where I grew up as a child, maybe about 45 minutes away. Anyway, it was a story about what was happening during the shooting. And one person said, while the gunman was there, the gunman was some young man, he said, I'm sorry for whatever happened that is making you do this. And I thought, wow. You know, the gunman shot this person. I don't know if he killed him, but he shot him. But that person was expressing some kind of empathy, some kind of compassion. I'm sorry for whatever happened to you that is making you harm other living beings. That's a compassionate statement to make to somebody who's holding a gun in your face. And that person, you know, who said that, their focus was compassion. You know, they saw, they didn't see, ah, here's somebody coming out to get me. They saw, here's a suffering sentient being. Yeah, because somebody who's going to commit mass murder has got to be in an incredible suffering. As well as creating the cause for their own incredible suffering. Okay? So when we see people like that, instead of being afraid of them, instead of hating them, think, may I take on all their suffering, and then may they be free of suffering. And if they're free of suffering, then they're not going to be doing the horrible things that they're doing. Even if someone broadcasts all kinds of unpleasant remarks about you throughout the 3,000 worlds. Okay, you got the situation? Somebody is criticizing you, trashing your meditation, trashing you, yeah, lying about you, ruining your reputation throughout the 3,000 worlds. The entire universe, they're criticizing you too and telling all your mistakes and making up lies about you. Okay? You got the scene? Would you usually feel? Yeah? I mean, forget the 3,000 worlds. We can't stand it. If somebody criticizes us to one person, yeah, let alone the whole universe full of sentient beings. Okay. But here, what's he saying? In return, with a loving mind, speak of his good qualities. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And we're going, he's trashing me throughout the 3,000 worlds, lying about me, ruining my reputation, making my friends turn against me, and you're telling me to have a loving mind towards this obnoxious person and speak of his good qualities? I told you that, you know, the advice is the opposite of what we want to do. Yeah. So why should we have a loving mind towards this person who's criticizing us? And why should we speak of his good qualities when he doesn't have any? He only has negative qualities because anybody who criticizes me doesn't have one single good quality. Okay? This is a challenging verse, isn't it? Okay? So again, this verse is teaching us, yeah, to practice fortitude. We don't need to fly off the handle and get angry, get defensive, get full of resentment and retaliate just because somebody criticized us. Yeah, it really isn't called for. You know, many years ago I attended a Buddhist conference in Taiwan. And after this conference, they very kindly arranged, and they took us on like a little tour, and, you know, of different places in Taiwan. And, you know, I mean, they were very, very kind to us at the conference and on this little tour. And at the end, the master, at the closing ceremony, you know, the master was standing in the front of the room, and some of the organizers, like the monks and nuns who were very prominent in helping to organize, were standing up there. And the master starts out, you know, this monk did this and this and this to, you know, help the organize everybody applauded. And this nun did this and this and this and enabled this to be successful and everybody applauded. And so he does this for a couple of monks and nuns. And then he goes and he says, but this monk, I asked him to do something and he didn't do it. Yeah. And as a result, in this conference, you know, there was this weak link and this thing didn't work right. And he's the one who's responsible for it. And the master's criticizing his disciple in front of a whole room full of people. Now, how would you feel? And I watched this. And the monk just stood there and he took it. Yeah. He didn't run out of the room. He didn't cry. He didn't scream. He just took it. And I thought, this is a very close disciple of the master. This is one of his best disciples, because the master could do this, and that monk could take it. And how could he take it? It's part of his practice. Yeah. He could realize, you know, people can criticize me up, down, and across. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It's just a reflection of that other person's mind. And actually, you know what? Getting criticized can be really good. Because it makes us a little bit humble, you know, when we're getting arrogant and we're getting full of ourselves, some criticism does us some good, lowers our ego. Criticism also makes us more compassionate because we understand then how other people feel when they're criticized. And that can help us refrain from criticizing others because we don't want to hurt them because we know what it feels like to be hurt. Now, enduring difficulty also burns through negative karma. Yeah. So some negative karma that we created, the seeds were on our mind stream. When they ripen in terms of our getting criticized, then those seeds are ripened, they're finished, they can't appear again. So it's like purification. So there's some benefits to being criticized. So when we think like that, then we can look at the person who's criticizing us, and look at him with a loving mind because he's actually benefiting us by helping us purify our defilements and generate good qualities. And in return, we can speak of his good qualities with a loving mind. We don't need to hold on to a grudge, because holding on to a grudge only eats away at our own happiness. Pretty amazing, huh? But it's true. Shall we try another one? Oh, here's another good one. Though someone may deride and speak bad words about you in a public gathering. Okay? You got the situation? You're sitting here in this room and somebody comes up and points the finger at you and derides you and speaks bad word about you. You're such an idiot. You did this wrong. You did that wrong. I can't trust you. You're a liar. You're a thief. Blah, 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 blah. And everybody here sitting and watching. You got the same? how do we handle, you know, our usual thing is to get angry, isn't it? Okay. Looking on her as a spiritual teacher, bow to her with respect. Oh, come on. Yeah? This person's criticizing me in front of all of you, and I'm supposed to bow to her with respect and see her as a spiritual teacher? That's too much. But if we don't do that, what's the alternative? We get angry. Yeah. We either break down and start crying because our feelings are hurt, or we start barraging that other person with criticism. We start a quarrel, yeah, create a lot of bad feelings, a lot of negative karma. That's the alternative. Or we stuff our anger inside and again. You know, and then we go home and our stomach is just knotted up because we're stuffing away our anger. And now we have nightmares. That's not a very good alternative. Okay? So what do you think about that? Looking on her as a spiritual teacher and bowing to her with respect is not so bad. Okay. One time I was giving a talk at a bookstore in Seattle. It was a public venue, and it was, you know, on a new book that had come out. And so I'm talking, and then, you know, one lady raises her hand, and she says, "How you describe Buddhism is incorrect. I am also a Buddhist, and my teacher says that da 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 da, and you said dee 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 dee, and what you explained is incorrect. You know, you should really learn Buddhism better." You know, said this to me in front of this whole crowd of people who had come for the book signing. So I just stood there and let her go on. And when she finished, I said, "Thank you." And then she sat down, and then I went on the talk. Yeah. Then afterwards, when I was doing the book signing, some people came up to me and said, "I can't believe, you know, that she said that, and we can't believe that you just said thank you after it." And I thought, well, what else could I have said? Yeah. "No, your teacher doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm right, you're wrong. You tell your teacher to come study with me. He doesn't know what..." You know? You know, all I could really say, I mean, she was up in arms. All I could really say was thank you. That was it. It ended the whole thing. Yeah, if I had replied or justified or defended myself, the whole thing would have just gone on and escalated. Yeah. And to me it was like, whatever, you know. Like, okay, she criticizes me. If other people are going to believe it, they believe it. If other people aren't going to believe it, that's nice too. But, just leave it. Okay, let's see. Oh, gotta do this one too. Even if a person for whom you've cared like your own child regards you as an enemy. Okay, so somebody that you've really cared for, who, you know, and you really care about, and somebody who you've benefited, yeah, turns against you and looks at you as an enemy. You ever had that happen? Somebody betray your trust? somebody you care about completely turn against you, yeah, and do something awful or hurt your feelings horribly. Okay. What do we recommend it to do? Cherish him specially, like a mother does her child who is stricken by sickness. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay. So somebody who has betrayed our trust, I don't know about you, but for me, that's one of the most painful things. Somebody that I've really trusted, who I really have cared about, yeah, who I feel very close to or benefited in some way, then completely turns and looks at me as an enemy, criticizes me, calls me names, walks out, won't even talk to me. You have that situation ever happen? Yeah? I think we've all kind of had that happen. And when it happens, we usually feel like we're the only person in the world who's ever had that happen to them. No one else has ever hurt as badly as we hurt after somebody that we care about turns their back on us. Yeah, we feel kind of destroyed inside. That's basically our self-centered thought. So the advice here, yeah, cherish him specially like a mother does her child who is stricken with sickness. Yeah, if you have a baby, if you have a young child and your child has a bad fever and they're delirious, yeah, you know how people are when they're delirious with a fever? You know, they may hit you. They may scream against you. They may, you know, call you names. They don't know what they're doing because the fever has made them, you know, delirious. So if you're a parent, your child is delirious in this way, and your child hits you or calls you names, do you take that personally? Or do you look at your child and say, wow, my child's really sick. Yeah, this kid is so sick from this fever. And you pour your compassion out to this kid. Anything you can do to help the child recover from the fever, you do it. You don't sit there at that time and go, who are you doing? What are you doing? Hitting your mother? Calling your mother names? Who do you think you are? I'm going to whack you. You don't do that to a sick kid, do you? Yeah. You realize that they're suffering and they don't know what they're saying and what they're doing. So in the same way, when there's somebody who we were close to who turns against us, they're like a delirious child. Their minds are confused. Their minds are suffering. They're not in their right mind. So why be angry? Why take what they're saying or doing personally? They're in a state of great suffering. Have compassion for them. Okay. Make some sense? Okay, so I think that's enough. These thought training practices are very powerful. Yeah, they don't coddle us. Oh, somebody criticized you, poor baby. They're so mean, make bad to them. No. Yeah? They're really challenging us to transform how we look at the situation and to look at the situation in an entirely different way. When we do that, how we experience it completely changes. Okay. So this takes time, it takes training. That's why it's called thought training. That's why we practice the Dharma. We need repetition, we need familiarization. It takes time and training. But if we put in the time and energy to do this, it can, you know, how we see situations completely changes 180 degrees. And then we have a very strong mind. We have fortitude. And we don't get whacked out by what other people say or do. But our mind is able to be steady. Yeah. And we have inner composure and inner strength. Yeah. And as a result, we're on the path to Buddhahood. Okay, so let's do that. So, we're not going to have questions and answers tonight because the time's up. And because tonight's the last night, so I can't continue with all the unanswered ones tomorrow. So we just won't have any. But also because it's late this evening. Okay. So I really refer you to transforming adversity into joy and courage, and don't believe anything you think, to really, you know, study these texts. And when you study the text, read a little bit and then sit and think about it. And take out situations that happen to you in your own life and try thinking in this new way in order to transform your mind. And, you know, base this new way of thinking on actual situations that have happened to you in your life. Then it isn't theoretical. Yeah, then you really have to work at it and see, you know, how the thought training practice is really true and work at changing our mind. But as we do so, then we are reconditioning our mind and training our mind in a new way. And we get a lot more confidence, and our mind will be much stronger and calmer when we face suffering or criticism or whatever. Okay? So let's just sit for a minute, a few minutes of digestion meditation, and then we'll dedicate. So remember, think about something you heard during the talk, you know, remember it, apply it to your life so you can take it home with you. Sentient beings, and it touches them and brings them peace. This man,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha,
that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.